Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm here to introduce our speaker, Andrea Grant. Tim was originally scheduled to give this talk, but he has a little health issue. Not anything serious, but he wasn't able to come this morning. I'm sure he'll be fine in a few days. So last night, about 7 o'clock, I sent out a call to say, hey, anybody want to give tomorrow's talk? Stepped in at the very last minute. So she's going to talk about compassion, which she talked about this past Tuesday. So if you've never come on Tuesday evenings, this will give you an idea of the kind of talk she might hear on Tuesdays. So just a little background on Andrea. She has served the community as work leader, as assistant Tenzo, and also Tenzo. I ordained her earlier this year. When was that?
June 22nd.
June 22nd.
This long ago.
I ordained her along with her partner, Jeremy. And she is a scientist by profession. She once spent a year at the South Pole. Some of you were here for her presentation on that. And so glad to have you here for the Dharma Talk. So, welcome, Andrea.
Thanks, Ted. Ooh, I have a loud voice, so I have to let me know if I'm too loud. This is usually the problem for me. So on Tuesday nights, we give series of talks. We set the topics ahead of time, which is nice. It's the priests in training who give the talks, and so it's nice for us to have topics assigned to us. It gives us a little bit of structure. So we've been doing a series. Right now we're doing the Brahma Viharas, which are the divine abodes, which are these mind states that we can cultivate that help us open our heart. And so the four Brahma Viharas are loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So this last week on Tuesday, I gave the second in the series on compassion. When they'd originally set the schedule for Tuesday nights, I was assigned ill will, and I was really excited because I thought, oh, I could talk about ill will all day long. But then the schedule shuffled, and I got compassion, and I thought, oh, I have to work a little bit. So I always like to start with a definition. So compassion, so when I read, I have to lean down. Anyway, you'll get used to me. So compassion from the Latin means to suffer with. So come is with and passion is suffering. But there's implied in it this element of action. So there's some kind of an outward reaching energy that's involved in that. So it's this idea of the awareness of suffering of others and some wish to relieve it. The other thing I looked into when I was thinking about definitions is looking at some of the different feeling words. I'm one of those people who gets confused between like sympathy and empathy and all those feeling words. So I just looked at the three words, sympathy, empathy, and compassion, because I was trying to tease out a little bit like what are the differences between those. So sympathy is concern, but not necessarily shared emotion. So, oh, that's too bad. Which can really easily turn into pity. Oh, that's too bad for you. It's a nice thing, but it can be kind of a knife edge if you're not careful with it. So sympathy is this concern without shared emotion. Empathy is a more general perspective taking and usually involves shared emotion. So this person is sad and I'm also feeling some sadness with them. So I'm mirroring their feelings to some degree. And then compassion is when those mirrored feelings from empathy also have this extra little spark, this desire to help somehow. The other thing I like to look at with some of these words is the idea of the near and far enemy. Have you guys heard of that, the near and far enemy? Some of you? So compassion is this feeling people's feelings and you know being aware of suffering, wanting to relieve it. And the opposite of that, so the far enemy, which is just the opposite, is pretty obvious. It's something like cruelty. So it's just this like completely opposite desire to create suffering in some way. But what I really love is this idea of a near enemy, which is something that looks like the thing we're talking about, but there's something different about it. There's something not quite right, and it can often be really negative. So in this case, the near enemy is something like grief or pity. So there's that kind of a judgment or a separation there, especially with pity. And the thing about near enemies is they can lead to morass and inaction instead of inspiring us to do some kind of action. So compassion is also central to bodhicitta. How many people have heard the word bodhicitta? Okay, some of you, most of you. So bodhicitta is a word that we use in Buddhism that is describes the impulse or the desire for spiritual awakening. That's kind of what brought us here, more or less, on some level. And you can think of a desire for spiritual awakening as being awakening to a heartfelt concern for others. And the way that we develop bodhicitta is often by training in compassion. So they're really linked. This desire for spiritual awakening we're going to develop through developing compassion or cultivating compassion. In the Zen tradition, in our tradition, compassion is often represented by the bodhisattva of Avalokiteshvara, or Kuan Yin. He or she has many names. So this is the bodhisattva who hears the cries of the world and is often depicted with 1,000 arms, so the arms are reaching out to help. So when I realized that this was going to be my topic, I thought, I have to bring in the statue from home. So this is... Ooh, it's dangerous. This is the statue that we have on our altar at home. So we have a small altar at home. And this is Kuan Yin. So this is the female or Chinese incarnation of Avalokiteshvara. She only has two arms in this one. But this is the bodhisattva of compassion. And as soon as I heard, when I first started coming here to Zen Center and started practicing, and I heard about Avalokiteshvara and Kuan Yin, I said, that's the statue we have to have on our altar at home. So I was immediately drawn to this representation. Let's put it back there. Because I've always felt this sort of connection to compassion and this desire to cultivate it. I'm too animated for this gizmo. It's also the table is a little dicey with the... Anyway, I haven't knocked it over yet. So I felt this immediate connection with compassion, because that is a lot of what has brought me into this practice, is this, I want to connect with other people. I want, you know, and this idea of the bodhisattva vows that we're going to chant at the end of the talk, and that part of the reason I ordained is that I wanted to dedicate my life to ending suffering for all beings. Like, this is something that really calls to me. But it's been a struggle for me. I often get stuck in what I call suffering paralysis. So I see all this suffering, either individually in people in front of me, or like on the news, or just thinking about globally all the suffering in the world, and I'm just overwhelmed and I feel like I'm drowning in it. And so I don't do anything because I'm paralyzed by all the suffering. You know, I even notice that in interpersonal relationships, if someone's really suffering, sometimes I want to turn away and I'm like, it's too much. Like, I can't go there, even though part of me wants to. So there's a suffering paralysis. The other thing I've noticed when I want to cultivate compassion and I want to help is that I'm doing unhelpful helping. So help that nobody asked for, or help that isn't really going to solve the problem or makes me feel better, or I know better and I should tell you what to do. And so many of us, I'm assuming, have engaged in that kind of unhelpful helping. So at home we always joke like, I'm helping, which usually means I'm driving you crazy. So suffering paralysis, unhelpful helping. And the other barrier that I've struggled with personally in cultivating compassion is that people are difficult. And as much as I have this sort of abstract compassion and I want to end suffering for people, when there's somebody in front of me that's driving me nuts, that is not the first feeling that comes up. Usually it's a little more frustrating. And so in the abstract, there's this desire, this aspiration. But when it comes down to real people, and especially the closer they are to me, the more difficult I find it to tap into my compassion. So those are things that I've struggled with in my cultivation for compassion. So when I was preparing for this talk, I was down in the library wandering around, and my eyes just happened to fall upon this book, and I thought, this is perfect. So the book is called Training in Compassion, Zen Teachings on the Practice of Lojong. It's by Norman Fisher, who was previously the abbot at the San Francisco Zen Center. So Lojong, has anyone heard of Lojong? A few of you? Yeah. So Lojong is actually a Tibetan Buddhist practice, so it's called a mind training program. And it's specifically to cultivate compassion. So it's to develop compassion. So I thought, it's a Tibetan program, but it's by a Zen author. So I decided I could use the book. So we're going to just kind of go through the book. Obviously, I'm not going to get into every detail of the book, but I just wanted to describe the structure of the program. So the heart of it is that there are 59 slogans that you work with. And they're divided into 7 points. And so the slogans are just little pithy sayings that kind of teach us something. And you might work with a slogan for a day or a week, or he said you could work with a slogan for a year. So it's not like a linear process that you kind of check off quickly. But it's this idea that these are these things that you just sort of work with and think about and hold with you for a while and just notice what comes up for you. So I'm going to just briefly go over the 7 points and then talk a little bit about the structure, and then I'll come back through the 7 points in more detail. So the 7 points of this mind training program are: 1, you resolve to begin. So we showed up. 2, we train in empathy and compassion, which can also be called absolute and relative bodhicitta. So we'll get into all of that in a minute. 3, we transform bad circumstances into the path. 4, make practice your whole life. 5, assess and extend. 6, the discipline of relationship. And 7, living with ease in a crazy world. So when I started the book, I thought, the structure is a little bit weird. So first of all, we're starting off with some of the really hard stuff. So especially this point 2, train in empathy and compassion. So these are profound Buddhist teachings on emptiness, the idea that the universe is made of absolute love that includes everything. So this absolute compassion, which is something that you can't wrap your normal logical mind around. And then relative compassion, or relative bodhicitta, which is like dealing with real people and their real suffering and showing up for that. And so those are kind of difficult tasks. So it's starting with this hard stuff, these maybe esoteric things, and things that maybe we would see naturally only after we've been practicing for a long time. The first time I sit down on the cushion, I am not filled with profound teaching on emptiness. Maybe you are, but not me. So this is something that gets cultivated a long time. So I thought, why is this at the beginning? It's a little bit difficult. These teachings that can't be approached logically, and then sort of the real endless suffering of the world with real people. And the part about working with other people specifically, the discipline of relationship, wasn't until step 6. And I'm like, isn't that the whole point? So why is that at the end? But then the more I read the book, the more I realized the structure is actually very ingenious. So first, we are building up motivation for the difficult work ahead. This is not going to be easy. For me personally, as I talked about before, my barriers to compassion, those are things that are deep set that I've had my whole life. It's not going to be, I'm just going to snap my fingers and they're going to disappear. So this is going to be difficult work to look at some of these habits and ideas that I have. So we need to build up some motivation. We need to ground ourselves in our aspiration. Why are we here to begin with? Why am I willing to do this work? So that's the first step. And the second point is that we're going to gently probe some of our really fixed ideas about the nature of reality and self and other. So this is where we're looking at emptiness, which I'd like to think of as boundarylessness, where we're looking at that the nature of the universe is love and that it encompasses everything. And so we want to start to, you know, if we have a lot of false assumptions, or if we have really fixed ideas about self and other, and this is the way the world is, and this is, I know this for sure, and I know that for sure, if we're stuck in those really fixed ideas, it's going to be really hard to change much about ourselves. And so the second point, this train in empathy and compassion, is allowing us to start looking at those a little bit and to start probing them and questioning, like, is that really true? Do I really know this thing about that person's inner intentions that they never said to me? You know, so to start questioning some of that certainty. And then there's several points where we're really working on ourselves. For a long time, we have to really turn inward and work on ourselves. Most of us have spent our lives running away from suffering, from discomfort, and from negative emotions. I certainly have. I mean, I came here so that I could surgically remove all my anger. Right? I thought if I just practice long enough, I won't have that feeling anymore, and then everything will be great. And so I've spent most of my life just running away from suffering. I cover it up. I try to distract myself from it. I have 47 years of habit energy, along with whatever cultural karma or everything else is coming in for me, that I have been practicing turning away from suffering, hiding it, repressing it, distracting myself from it. And if I can't even see my own suffering, how can I look at yours? How can I really be present with it? So there's a long section in the middle where we're really just working on ourselves. And finally, after that, we're able to start approaching others and to show up more directly in our lives with other people, and then expand this out into the other realms of our daily life. So this living with ease in a crazy world. So we really have to train to face our own suffering. This is going to take courage, stamina, unflinching resolve, and intimacy with suffering and pain. Our old way was avoidance. We probably engaged in some self-protection. Those always seem like a good idea at the time, but I've found, and I invite you to explore it, that when I engage in a lot of self-protection, like avoidance or distraction, all that does is fuel my grasping and my aversion, and that causes more pain. I just think, oh, if I can just get through this, whatever's going on, or, oh, if I can just have that colleague at work stop doing this thing. It's that cycle of like, oh, if this will just change, then everything will be fine. If this just goes away, then everything will be fine. So for me, it cultivates that grasping and aversion. One of the things that Norman mentioned in the book, he says, negative emotions are not our enemy. They're our treasures. I wasn't ready for that perspective. But I think he's right. So we live in this basic, totally normal human mess of likes and dislikes. So that's kind of the human condition. And I've certainly found that constantly trying to fulfill my desires doesn't work. Oh, if I could just get this, then everything will be fine. There's always another desire. So constantly trying to fulfill the desires doesn't work. And constantly trying to eliminate them doesn't work. Oh, if I could just stop being angry, if I can just stop doing this, then I'll be okay. But he says that it's actually through our likes and dislikes and the ensuing suffering that we find spiritual growth. So we're not going to be able to go around this or over or under it. We really got to go through it. And that's actually where the growth is going to occur. Things like resentment, anger, and greed are basic visceral human emotions. We can stay close to them when they're there. So when they arise, we can meditate on them. I like to think of them as like a fire on the stove. I am not going to walk away and leave that burning. I am going to get right on that stove and I'm going to tend to that situation. And that's how I want to respond to my negative emotions or my suffering. Thich Nhat Hanh talks, especially about in his book about anger, he talks about running towards it like a crying baby. So when that anger arises, all of my attention can go towards that. What is happening? How does it feel? How can I attend to this? Instead of just acting out from it or like trying to pick something up to distract myself from it. And when fear and resistance arise, even to this practice as well, those are also not obstacles. They're not barriers. They are the practice at that moment. So if you're stuck in resistance, I don't want to do this, I don't want to look at this, the resistance is your practice at that moment. When they arise, that's your path. So it's important that we don't back away from these things, these negative emotions, our resistance to these things, our suffering itself, but we learn to engage with them. So our old way has been avoidance and self-protection, but increasing our suffering in some ways. And instead, in this book and in this program, they invite us into a new way where we investigate, we explore, we're curious about these experiences, maybe even welcoming of them. So we become familiar with our bad habits, and instead of drowning in our jealousy or anger or judgmentalness or whatever's going on, full of self-blame, as if the anger were somehow a substance ingrained in us, our essential character, we can instead study the anger. He says to become curious about it, almost scientific about it. What's happening? How does it feel inside of you when it comes up? How does it want you to think and act? He suggests even studying it until we see it as a kind of an entity, something that's independent of us. And something I heard early on when I first started practicing, I was in the middle of a conversation with somebody, and the phrase just came out, there is anger here. And I was like, oh, I really like that. I've struggled with anger a lot in my life, and for a long time I called myself an angry person, as though it was like some core part of who I was. And I... it was helpful for me to talk about it, to acknowledge that I had a lot of anger, but I can see that it also perpetuated the story about myself as being angry. Well, I'm an angry person. There's nothing. I'm going to be angry too. I'm going to be angry tomorrow. Like, it just made the anger keep coming and coming. And instead, this idea of, oh, there's anger here. It's just like there's anger out in the universe. And some days, more of it has flowed into my body than others. And other days, it's going to flow out, and it's going to probably be with someone else. And I can be present with them when they're having it. And I had this vision. I was like, oh, it's kind of like parts of air, right? Air is made up of oxygen and nitrogen and carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide and all these other molecules, methane, you know. And when I'm breathing it in, it's not my oxygen and it's not my nitrogen. There's just, it's all out there, and some of it comes into my body, and maybe there's a little bubble. Our gas, the dryer vent broke on our... The vent broke on our dryer, so we were running the dryer at night, and so, of course, the bedroom was filled with carbon monoxide. It's really bad. So, you know, that day, there was more carbon monoxide there, and so that was how I was like, oh, that's how it feels to me, that some days it's like, oh, there's more anger here, and it's come in, but I don't have to identify as anger. I am anger. I am angry. I can just let it flow in and let it flow out. So that was really helpful to me, to be like, oh, I can become curious about these feelings or these things that arise in me. Instead of either pushing them away or like over attaching to them as an identity. So there's more to being, more to compassion than just being nice and sympathetic. Of course, we aspire to that. That's nice. But compassion is really a profound recognition that self and other are not fundamentally different. And if we want to love and connect authentically, we have to liberate ourselves from our ingrained self-centeredness, this small point of view we have where we're worried about our problems. Oh, you don't understand. It's different for me. Oh, I'm the bump on the log. So we have to liberate ourselves from that somehow. And we have to work on our own selves and our own minds with some seriousness. And compassion isn't just about other people. It's also about ourselves. So many of us need to have compassion towards ourselves. I certainly do. I have a very critical voice in my head that I need to learn to make friends with. But it's also about going deeper than self or other and trying to see the interconnectedness of all beings. So now I'm going to dip back into the seven parts. So I'm going to go back through them with a little bit more detail. So the first part, the first point, is resolve to begin. So here we're trying to get in touch with our deepest, best motivations. So this is really looking at our life and recognizing that we're here. Why did we come here? What brought us into this practice? It's important that we know what we're doing and why, so we have a connection with our motivation, so that we can start to get over our old habit of self-obsession and start to develop genuine empathy and compassion. And this immediately reminded of, I'm sober, so I'm familiar with the 12-step tradition. So, and in the 12 steps, in the third step, there's a prayer that people say, and one of the phrases in it is, relieve me of the bondage of self. And I have always loved that, because I often experience separate self as kind of a prison. I'm stuck in my viewpoint, and nobody understands, and da-da-da, and it gets very sort of prison-like. And I'm the one keeping myself in that prison. This is something I've realized. But it can be hard to know how to get out of it. And so that's, for me, that was resolve to begin. Oh yeah, that's right. I want to be able to get out of this prison that I've built for myself. So getting in touch with our motivation is not something that we're going to complete, you know, check off, and be done with. We're going to come back to it over and over again. When we get down into the daily grind of things, we get really lost in the details of life and in problems, and it can kind of down under the surface of the water, and we need to intentionally stay connected to our higher goals to remind ourselves that we're spiritual practitioners. So this idea of resolving to begin is something that we're going to come back to over and over again. But it's a good place to start with our feet on the ground. The second point is train in empathy and compassion. So here we're going to awaken a willingness to be with our own suffering and with the suffering of others. So we're going to contemplate at some depth the nature of self and other, a conceptual and experiential understanding of what it would mean to totally embrace compassion, to end suffering for all beings, to really authentically receive others. You have to be willing to deal with pain and suffering, both yours and others. So there's two parts to this train in empathy and compassion. The first part is absolute bodhicitta, or absolute compassion. And this is the idea that life is like a dream. So it's all those assumptions that we've made. How can we investigate how they're like a dream? And that life is built on a foundation of all-encompassing love. That there is endless peace in the world. So we're going to spend some time looking at absolute bodhicitta, and then we'll spend some time looking at relative bodhicitta or relative compassion. And this is that loving actual people is more difficult. It's never-ending. We have our bodhisattva vows, which are literally impossible to achieve, and yet we vow to engage with them, to do them. And in this section on relative bodhicitta, there's also a practice. This is where the practice of Tonglen appears. Has anyone heard of Tonglen? A few of you? Okay. So Tonglen it's also called sending and receiving. It's a really powerful practice, and I thought about guiding people through it, but I've decided not to because it can also be really intense. And so it's something to take carefully, and if some part of you says, I don't want to do that, then don't do it. Don't worry about it. So I'm just going to talk about what it is, but I'm not going to guide us through it. But the idea with Tonglen is ascending and receiving. We're going to breathe in all the suffering of the world on the in-breath. And on the out-breath, we're going to breathe out light and ease and peace. And he talks, Norman has some nice visual images, so if you're a visual kind of person, he was saying on the in-breath, when you're breathing in the suffering, it's like you're in this black, tarry goo, and you're just breathing it all in. And then on the out-breath is just light and ease coming out. And in this process, our bodies transform the suffering into peace. So I found it very powerful to do, and I encourage you if that sparks something in you to try it out. I'm sure there's guided meditations you can find on the internet to guide you through it, but you can also just do it on your own. And if it feels funny to you, don't worry about it. If you read this book, you don't have to go through it front to back. You can read through it, and if something really jumps out at you, you can work with that slogan. You don't have to do them linearly, as though it's the only path. So sending and receiving, we transform suffering into peace with our breath. So this absolute bodhicitta, life is like a dream, emptiness, and relative bodhicitta, the bodhisattva vows, never-ending suffering, those are difficult. It's likely that we're not completely ready for this step at this point because it's kind of early in the process, and we're going to need to come back to it. But it's helpful to have it be here to give us really strong determination for the work that's coming because it's going to be hard. The third point is we transform bad circumstances into the path. So training is not a walk in the park. Many bad circumstances will arise every day. We need to be ready for these difficulties because we know they're going to come up. And if they discourage us and we don't know how to cope with them, then we're not going to get very far if we just immediately throw up our hands. So there's a lot of sections in here about this kind of bad circumstance, this kind of bad circumstance, this will come up, this will probably come up. And this is the meat of where we start to learn that we no longer have to strategize this constant self-protection. We don't have to keep ourselves safe in that way. We can make use of our suffering directly to deepen and strengthen our practice and our connection to life. The next point is make practice your whole life. So practice is not a task on your to-do list that you're going to check off. It's great to do your sitting meditation every morning, and if you like checking things off like I do, go for it. But practice isn't just another thing on our to-do list. It's how we do our to-do list. It's how we do everything in our life. So we're awakening in each moment. And at this point, we've reached at least the level of questioning our impulse to run away from or eliminate our difficulties. We've started to see that they're going to come up and that we don't need to just run away immediately. We can stay with them. And we find as we practice at this point that our level of seriousness and commitment increase until there's no difference between mind training, the set of 59 slogans, and your whole life. They've started to permeate everything. You're practicing all the time, even when it feels like you're not. Even when you're at the movies, shoveling in popcorn, like you're still practicing, even if you don't think you are. And then we have an assessment, assess and extend. That's the fifth point. So here we need to get some feedback on our training. We need to be able to assess and regulate our practice with some subtlety. We need to be able to encourage ourselves to stay on the path. And here we start to recognize our inner signs of distraction and avoidance, and we're learning to dance with them. So up until now, the first 5 points, we've been mostly working with our own mind. And finally now, by this point, we are ready to work with other people. So the sixth point is the discipline of relationship. And this is where the real work, the real difficulty begins, at least for me. And I felt very validated by the structure in this book. I was like, oh, this isn't just me that has these issues. This whole program is designed around this. So here's the thing. We learn to be human through our interactions with other people. And we need other people so much. This is a feature of being human. And yet nothing is more troublesome than other people. And the closer we are, the harder it is to work with them. The people we hurt the most are usually our family members, our spouses, our children. It's a terrible, it's a tragic irony, and that's the way it is. Conflict is not the exception to human relations. It's actually the rule. We have to be willing to wade into that deep water, that swamp. We are going to bring honesty and fierceness and a willingness to plunge into the depth of human feelings. How can we ever develop compassion if we can't get down to the basics and deal with people as they actually are and the world as it actually is, with all of its messiness? He mentioned in here something I really liked. Dealing with other people is actually dealing with ourselves dealing with other people. Like, it's this stuff, ooh, yeah, that we're dealing with. And the other people are just doing their people thing. I thought, oh yeah, that's really true. So here we're going to take ourselves in hands. We can be different in our interactions with others. When we are different, we are going to find that others are different too. And without understanding it, we have been co-creating with other people the conflicts and interpersonal hassles of our lives. I do want to add a caveat. You know, when we talk about like systemic oppression, the person being oppressed is not co-creating that conflict in their life. I'd like to be clear about that. But I'm talking about run-of-the-mill, oh my God, that guy that's disgusting me at work, right? Like that kind of stuff. Like we are co-creating a lot of that conflicts and interpersonal struggles. So this is what we can investigate here. And there are a lot of slogans in this section. I was like, oh, working with other people is really difficult and we're going to need a lot of help. So it goes on and on and on. Many slogans. And then finally, the seventh point is living with ease in a crazy world. So this is just living with grace and ease in all of our circumstances. There's a lot of repetition and overlap in this chapter, and I was like, oh, come on. And I was like, oh, the same themes show up for me over and over again in my life, so I probably need a lot of repetition in my slogan work. So he says it's a testament to the persistence of human folly. So at this final point, we learn to take our own and the world's craziness into accord and to just live with it with grace and ease. So in closing, the slogans do not require us to be perfect. To the contrary, they recognize specifically that the mind is extremely difficult to train and that mostly the training is going to proceed from failure to failure. You're doing it right. That's totally normal. So don't be discouraged. And when you notice that you are a hot mess, just stop right there. Take a breath. Try to let go of any frustration or recrimination. And with that breath, just return to your positive intentions and being willing to do this over and over and over. That's the essential practice. Oh, I'm a mess again. Okay, come back. Okay, come back. Embracing other people's suffering is impossible if we can't even bear our own suffering. We have such a habit of denying and running away. We deny, we distract. We are so intent on making something go away that we don't actually feel it. Notice that. Notice it when it arises. For me, I notice that a lot with my phone. Sometimes I'm like, oh, I need to do this thing, and I pick up my phone, and it's very intentional. And other times, I'm sort of sitting there, and the next thing I know, my phone's open, and I'm playing Words with Friends. And I'm like, oh, what happened there? Like, was something going on that I was trying to avoid? Even just boredom is the thing I'm trying to avoid. So I'm like, oh, why did I pick that up? So for me, it's really nice. It's something that's with me all the time. It's this great reminder of like, oh, am I distracted now? Am I running away from something now? The other thing I've noticed a lot, especially in my Zazen practice, is my other go-to distraction is thinking about work, prioritizing my to-do list and solving work problems. If I'm sitting in Zazen and a pain comes up or some feeling that I want to feel, the next thing I know, I'm 10 minutes into planning next week's to-do list. And so that's another real touch point for me. Like, oh, I have unknowingly cultivated this habit of work thinking to sort of take me away from whatever present moment I want to avoid. So this training program is about training to turn towards difficulty instead of away from it. And we have to start with ourselves, deeply and completely. Compassion for other people will arise naturally once we are no longer flinching at ourselves. I guarantee this. We do not need to worry about it. So we practice situating ourselves differently with respect to ordinary human confusion, resistance, pain, fear, grief. And instead of hoping that they're going to go away and we will be free of them, we're going to take them to a deeper level and look at their underlying reality. What's actually going on when we're upset and angry? We can start to unhook from the blaming and the wishing and the self-pity and see what's actually going on. Time is passing. Change. Birth and death. And we can slip below this level of desire and confusion and see that in this very moment, time is passing. Things are transforming. All of our vows are included in this one commitment, to be committed to paying attention to our lives, to being honest about what is going on, unflinchingly realistic about how we are behaving and thinking. The heart of mind training is here. Don't go to sleep. Don't deny. Don't make excuses. Don't blame anyone. Don't blame yourself. Don't wish for something else. Live your life with your eyes wide open and your heart wide open, no matter what. So thank you for listening. And I would love for discussion or questions or comments. Yeah.
It's one thing to live at ease in a crazy world. And I think we can all resonate with that.
Yeah.
But it's another thing to live at ease in an evil world, and that's, I think, what a lot of us have been feeling from a lot of recent developments.
Yeah.
So a word like crazy connotes a lot of different things to different people.
Yeah.
So that's kind of amorphous to me. What does it mean? Does that mean to accept craziness? But then does that also mean to accept evil?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I struggled with the word craziness itself because that can be kind of a negative thing. Oh, you're being crazy. And so I was like, ugh. And to me, what I interpreted that as, before your question, I would have said, oh, it's just a, sort of the hecticness of life, right? Living in the full catastrophe, like just, whoa, this stuff is going on and we're going to show up and be with it. And I hear what you're saying about living in an evil world. I don't know if the world is more evil than it ever has been. This isn't clear to me that there's more evilness. I feel like, personally, this is my own personal opinion, that the last maybe 5 or 10 years in America, things have kind of, we've pulled some of the covers off of what's actually going on, and there's a lot more direct, angry, cruel things and words happening. I'm not sure if there's more of them or if we have all just suddenly started to see them more clearly. So I think about the history of war and the history of horrifying things that people have done to each other over humanity. And so I think it's maybe always been as it is. Yeah.
I really like that book. And when I go on a longer retreat, try to pick 3 slogans from it at random.
Oh.
In my back pocket. And it seems helpful to just sometimes go through them.
Yeah.
Meditating, not all the time, of course, but just once in a while, kind of go through that.
Yeah.
It's very helpful.
Yeah, kind of like an anchor point in a retreat. Yeah. Does it help specifically? You don't have to answer this. Like if you're really struggling, like if you're having a difficult time in a retreat, you know what I mean? They come and go, these difficult times.
Yeah, I feel like I'm falling asleep and say, okay, now could bring these up and kind of go over almost like a mantra.
Yeah.
And
yeah, and a way to stay focused and present, but.
And
yeah.
They drift away. And
yeah.
But it's
very helpful. I love that.
And not just one other comment. If the term pity, I kind of treat it as a poor cousin, but still a value in some circumstances. And a lot of times what I'm seeing, I wish that some people would have just a spark of what I think would be the poor cousin of compassion, pity.
Yeah.
And I think that would prevent a lot of really horrible cruelty. Like, would we have pity on the Kurds? You know, like those horrible, horrible things that people are doing to each other, if there'd be even just a touch of pity in their heart.
That would something,
being so awful.
Yeah.
So, I'm a promoter of at least some pity.
Pity's better than nothing. Yeah. Right. Yeah, and to look at where it takes us if we spend too much time there.
So Tomlin is discussed in When Things Fall Apart.
Okay.
Which was a very helpful book to me like a year and a half ago. And I found that if you are resisting your suffering, any of your bad emotions, your anger, your anxiety, your sadness, your depression, if I am resisting those things and I'm putting up a wall to not feel them and experience them, I'm actually creating more suffering for myself because not only am I feeling the like negative emotions, but I'm feeling the fact that I can't get rid of them.
Right.
That's creating more suffering.
There's like a double layer.
Right.
Yeah.
Instead of just existing with my feelings, I'm existing with that and the fact that I can't get rid of them.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's I definitely relate to that comment. That's been a huge practice for me. Of there's all these negative emotions, and then for me there's this profound resistance to them, and that's mostly what I work with is my resistance. Did you find Tonglen specifically helpful with that? Yeah. Okay. Oh, cool. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I just really appreciated your talk. This morning I was having an argument with somebody that was not there, and I. At times, but kept winning.
Nice work.
And I kept going, oh my God, I have to get to meditation. I even told him that I'm just weak today. I just don't know, I promise. And you just really spoke. I'm a 12 stepper too.
Yeah.
And you just, it spoke to me.
Yeah.
At this, it's funny how you get what you need at that moment. So,
Thank you. I felt that about when I was writing it. I was like, oh, I didn't know I needed to read this book about compassion, but my God, I have to buy it now. This is a library copy, so I'll put it back down there. Yeah.
I find like when I get to where I'm resisting in meditation that I go to show tunes.
I'd be afraid that I would start singing. Sometimes I'm so deep in sort of a trance and meditation that I'm like, did I just make noise? Did I say something?
Did you say something with pity and grief?
I did. You know, that was funny when I looked it up about the near enemy of compassion. So this thing that can look like it but isn't always it. Grief or pity? Yeah.
Say something more about the grief.
You know, yeah, I was like, why did I write that? But I have had experiences of grief that were, I was just drowning in it, where it was overwhelming. And that's where I felt like, oh yeah, that leads to morass and inaction, where I'm just like, the grief is just devastating and I can't get out of it and I can't act in any way. You know, so it sort of morphs into depression somehow or something like that. And so for me, that kind of grief is, it doesn't help me fulfill my bodhisattva vows. It just leaves me isolated and so in that way, I think grief can be in your enemy. Obviously, grief is a completely natural human emotion. So I think it's something we all have to go through. But I think it was just, maybe a really heavy grief or a depressive grief, yeah. Yeah, Ben.
I found compassion is a very useful part of leadership. I'm president of an amateur radio club of 80 people, and we just lost our relationship with the fire department.
Mm.
We're going to have to be moving all our stuff out of there. And there's going to be some anger there.
Yeah.
And disappointment. And I've had a couple of angry emails already.
Mm-hmm.
And just a little bit of, I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
And these are important points. I'll bring that to the board. And I'll go, thank you. Mm-hmm. And they're just, it turns them around so fast. It's really almost a shock to me.
Yeah.
That how well that works.
Yeah, people just need to, they need to be heard.
They need to be heard.
Yeah.
And I don't want any negative things to come out in the open in the club. But I'm thinking I might want to put together a council process for them.
Yeah, just a way for them to...
them to air it out without getting them to yell at the city. That's not going to do any good.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's funny, like, what I was talking about, unhelpful helping. Like, that, you know, that's helpful helping. Like, realizing that sometimes helping is almost doing nothing. It's not nothing. But, like, sometimes just listening is actually the help that's needed. Yeah. Oh, cool. Yeah.
Thank you for your talk. It was wonderful.
Thanks.
I have studied or been taught or been told that a lot of anger is because I think I should be able to control things.
Mm-hmm.
Even in acquiring my own cravings, the objects of my own cravings, I'm angry because I can't bring that about. Or if I bring that about, the cost is too high. And I have a concrete example that plagues me almost daily. And that is driving on the freeway. It's one of the last bastions of true evil within my soul. And my favorite thing to hate is people who drive too close behind me. And of course, I have lots of fixed, even numerical ideas about what that means.
Mm-hmm.
But when I really look at how common are rear-end collisions... I've been hit by somebody from behind once in about 50 years of driving.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a very common event. And it usually doesn't happen on the freeway. It happens at stop signs, and it's pretty innocuous. So with all that blah, 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 what, and trying to analyze this and deal with the anger and deal with the negative emotions that I have with other people, and I've even transferred to that there are certain kinds of vehicles I don't like. They have about them an essence of evil. And what I find is that it's not the driving, it's not the danger, it's I'm affronted by the fact that you would get too close to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's my me coming back to have an independent, stable self that I'm protecting at all costs.
Yeah.
So it's really kind of an existential thing for me, and I'd like to ride the bus forever, but that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I'm taking a class right now on cultivating emotional balance, and we actually spent, so it's four Saturdays in a row, and we spent most of yesterday talking about anger. And, you know, one of the things they talk about is, so anger, if you think about it like evolutionarily, it's when something is thwarting our attempts to accomplish something, that's when anger arises. And evolutionarily, you can think about that being really useful, like if you need to get food and somebody is thwarting that, like, or some other thing that provides for your physical safety and ability to survive. Like, anger is an incredibly useful amount of energy to come up and deal with that situation. But mostly I find that's not, I mean, maybe someone's grabbing the last thing off the shelf at the grocery store, but usually that's not where it's coming up for me. It's coming up in these more existential threats to myself, my sense of self. Yeah. So, yeah. I guess it was really helpful to me that to recognize that anger is completely normal and natural and it's going to arise, and to just look at what's bringing it up. So, let's see. I can't remember the schedule. What time are we supposed to?
We probably have a minute.
Oh, okay, so we have time for a little bit more. If there's another comment.
What's the name of that book?
It's called Training in Compassion. Compassion, the Zen Teachings of Lojong.
Andrew, can you give an example of one of those?
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking, especially from the sixth point, I think about dealing with other people.
Oh, my God. I know. That's my favorite section. Oh, there's so many of them. Yeah. So, point six, the discipline of relationship. And I won't read them all. I'll just read a few. Don't be a phony. Don't talk about faults. Don't figure others out. Work with your biggest problems first. Abandon hope. Don't poison yourself. Don't malign others. Don't wait in ambush. Don't make everything so painful. Don't unload on everyone. Don't go so fast. So there's just lots of nice things. Yeah. As if there's another. Yeah. Yeah, they're great.
So is there, I don't know, like copies of that?
Of the book? Yeah, it's not in the library. It's called Training in Compassion. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it's down the library, so if you're a member, you can check it out, and if not, you can read it down there. Yeah. All right, I think we will turn it over, so thank you all for being with me today.